In the first hour today, the question we'll be discussing is this: why do birds sing? Now, if you ask that of a scientist who studies birds, he or she may well give you a pretty straightforward answer, at least to start, because we know that birds sing to attract mates. They sing as a way of defending their territory. And while that's all true, our guest for this hour of Focus 580, David Rothenberg, says that that is an incomplete explanation, because he argues that you can see birds singing after they have mated, and you can see and hear birds singing when there aren't any intruders or any competitors around. And above and beyond that, he would argue that the quality of bird song, it's more than it needs to be to do those jobs, which leads him to the conclusion that birds sing for the same reason that human beings make music, because they like it, because of the pure joy of singing the song. You can find some of these ideas in his recent book, Why Birds Sing, A Journey into the Mystery of Bird Song. It's published by Basic Books, and we'll talk this morning about what you will find in that book. Let me give you a little bit more background on our guest, David Rothenberg. He is a composer and a clarinetist who is known for bringing together improvisation by human musicians with the sounds of nature. He is also a philosopher and writer. In addition to the book that I have mentioned, Why Birds Sing, he's authored a number of others, the most recent titled Sudden Music, Improvisation, Art, Nature. That book came out in 2002. He's also editor of the Terra Nova book series published by MIT Press, looking at environmental issues as culture, not just policy. He's done writing and has appeared in other sorts of places. He's also associate professor of philosophy at the New Jersey Institute of Technology, and he's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions from people who are listening are certainly welcome. We'd like to involve you in the conversation. The only thing that we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief. And we ask that so that we can accommodate as many as possible and keep the program moving. But anybody who is listening can call here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if you'd like to join us, you can do that. Mr. Rothenberg, hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
I'm fine.
We appreciate you giving us some of your time today.
Sure.
I hope you're not too tired of talking about this subject now. I know you were on a long book tour, and you never get
much to say.
Okay, good. Very good. Maybe as a way of starting, let me ask this question. We know that many different animals use sound to communicate. They have various kinds of calls and signals that they use to attract one another, to alert one another to threats, and so forth. But then there are, among all those animals that use sound to communicate, there are a relatively small number that do something that is recognizable to us, or we might argue is music, and certainly birds are among them. What is it that makes bird song different from the kinds of communicative sounds that other animals might utter?
Well, the first thing that's different is that birds learn to sing. They're not born with the ability to sing. They have to learn. They usually learn by hearing grown-up birds singing, sometimes their parents, sometimes others. That's how they get a model of what they should learn to do. It takes them anywhere from several months to many years to learn to sing the proper song. Now, if you look at the whole animal world, there's very few animals that can learn to make sound, what scientists call vocal learning. You know, no other primates can do it except human beings. Chimpanzees can't learn to make sound. Dogs and cats can't officially learn to make sounds. They just make what they're born with the ability to make. Only songbirds, human beings, and whales and dolphins can learn to make sound. What do all those disparate animals have in common? You know, no one's quite sure. That's the first thing that's unique about them. But then you listen to the actual sounds that birds are making. These often long, sometimes short sounds that people for thousands of years have called songs. They've heard something musical in that. And I don't think it's accidental that these sounds appear musical to our ears. I also think an important thing to realize is they are not conveying specific information contained, like in the syntax. It's not, these sounds do not have a specific message they're getting across. Birds make other sounds that do. Bird calls. Birds make alarm calls. Sometimes they make specific alarm calls. A bunch of bird species make exactly the same sound only when a hawk flies overhead Otherwise, they make a different alarm sound if a cat's walking by or something. Those are specific messages. But what's the message in a mockingbird song that goes on for an hour at a time? Hmm. Or even just a short sound of a warbler singing? The message isn't so clear. The song serves this function, as you mentioned. You know, it's supposed to attract mates or to defend territories. But why are birds doing this with this kind of musical-sounding phrase that doesn't convey specific information? We're not quite sure why, but I think that you start to listen to these songs, listen to what birds sing, and it has a lot in common with music. It has more in common with human music than it does with human language.
Hmm. I mentioned at the beginning of the program that you have for a long time had this interest of combining music, the music that you would make and other musicians would make, with sounds of nature. In some cases, they're not sounds that are made by any living thing. In the case of birds, and we have your CD, Why Birds Sing, that we will play a little bit of so we can give people a chance to hear what we're talking about, so you won't just have to try to describe it and they to imagine it. We can actually play it for them. But how did you get interested in this idea of actually playing music with birds?
Well, with this particular project, you know, my friend, the artist Michael Pestel in Pittsburgh, invited me to go to the National Aviary that's over there and play along with the birds, something he'd been doing for years. And as I walked around with my clarinet through the aviary, one particular bird really seemed to respond to what I was doing. It really surprised me. That was a white-crested laughing thrush, a bird from Southeast Asia. And this bird really seemed to interact with the exact melodies I was playing. And I said, "What? What's going on? Can this happen? I thought birds had their set songs that they just sang one way." And that got me interested in reading and learning about this whole story. And that's when I found out that actually the science of bird song is much more tentative than I had thought. Because science must be so careful and so exact to make any kind of conclusions. Actually, science wasn't all that sure about why birds are doing what they're doing, because it's so hard to test.
Uh-huh.
And then I began to be interested in ways in which science and music might be combined to make sense of this. And I realized that although science and music say very different things about bird songs, they can fit together and support each other in interesting ways.
Well, I want to play a cut from the CD, Why Birds Sing, so people can hear this encounter between you and this particular bird, the white-crested laughing thrush. Why don't we do that?
Okay.
This is cut number 9 on this CD. Thank you. All right, there you have it. In case you've just joined us, that's our guest for the show this morning, David Rothenberg, clarinetist and composer, playing along with a white-crested laughing thrush, and this was recorded at the National Aviary in Pittsburgh in March of 2000, from his CD, Why Birds Sing, and that goes along with his book, Why Birds Sing, A Journey into the Mystery of Birdsong, and that book is published by Basic Books. It is in the bookstore now if you would like to read it, and as I said, David Rothenberg, our guest, he's composer, clarinetist, also an author and philosopher. He is an associate professor of philosophy at the New Jersey Institute of Technology.
Now, if you want to get that CD, it's now at present sold separately. So you'd have to get it from whybirdsing.com.
All right.
And various, you know, online places. But I believe a year from now, the paperback is going to have the CD in it.
Ah, very good.
Trying to figure that out.
Well, it is nice, as I say, it's nice to have that because you describe this encounter in the book, but you this way you can actually hear what it sounds like and hear the interaction between you and
it makes more sense, yeah. Maybe it makes sense. Maybe it doesn't make sense at all. Every time I hear it, it sounds very different. I think about it in a different way, and I'm not sure it's because I've read more about laughing thrushes or it's because I'm hearing something else going on.
Well, let's talk about the interaction between you and the bird and what you think about what's, obviously we don't know what the bird was thinking about, but what you were thinking about was going on there and whether in fact you think that the bird was really responding to the music that you were putting out and that there really was a kind of a duet, an improvised duet going on.
Well, I'll explain to you the evolution of my thought on this. When I was there, I had no idea what's going on. I said, huh? This bird is really responding in an interesting way. And at the time, I said, ah, well, he either is competing with me because he's defending his territory, or he's, trying to find a mate because he was all alone in this cage. And maybe he was, you know, thinking I might have something to do with that. And then later I read about them. I learned that although very little is written on this bird, even though it's quite common in Asia, they use sound in a complex social way, like most birds don't, but some species do, in that both the males and females sing, and it's believed they use sound for more complicated reasons than those two popular ones. They use it more to establish constant contact through the underbrush and identify where they are, members of a group and such. So he's a bird more used to playing along with similar sounds. And I think, like many birds, he particularly responded to certain, you know, rhythmic shapes and patterns of melody, as well as a sound quality that's like what he's used to. And because this guy was so alone, he probably hadn't heard this for a long time. Mm-hmm. The last time I went back there, there was a male and female, and they were both singing along. And I guess what this says is, you know, the more I've learned about this, you know, every species is so different from every other. Every bird species, and something that Darwin actually realized that since Darwin, many evolutionary biologists have forgotten about. You know, he wrote in The Descent of Man that birds have a natural aesthetic sense. Each species has a certain kind of thing that they like. That's what Darwin said. He totally could accept this approach. He said this is why birds have, you know, beautiful plumage and feathers, why they sing beautiful songs. Each species has its own sense of what they think is beautiful. Sometimes it overlaps with what we like. Other times it doesn't.
Hmm. I guess some people would ask the question, though, is really, if you talk about something like that, let's just take the songs, that they have a sense of what is beautiful. One might also make the argument that, well, what is they do is there are boundaries. The birds can't sing just anything. And while there may be interaction with other birds, and there are birds clearly that we know that appropriate little bits of the songs of other birds and make them their own. And while the songs are complex and have to be learned, there are specific songs that specific birds do sing, and it's not as if they could sing anything.
Well, it's interesting. You take a bird like the bullfinch in Europe, a very common small finch. In the wild, all it does is go, makes this little squeaky sound. Well, people raised him in captivity. They discovered this bird could whistle back right away, could sing back just about any tune you whistle to him. How could this be? In the wild, they never do anything like that. They had this ability that they never actually used. And for more than several hundred years, there were academies teaching bullfinches to sing in Europe, particularly in Germany, because this became such a fashion. But in the wild, they don't do anything like that at all. So what this shows is many birds have abilities that they can do that in their normal life they don't do. So in some senses, birds are capable of much more than they're supposed to do or usually do. But it is at the same time true what you said, that most birds make do fine with a very specific, defined song. And that's part of their aesthetic as well, I would say, and Darwin would agree with me.
Yeah.
The birds, but what is not efficient, what is not necessary or entirely comfortable in a mechanistic view is the fact that it's what they're actually singing. You know, it's not the simple, most fit, most sane thing to do, what birds spend their time doing. You know, nature is not just survival of the fittest and this grand, efficient machine. Evolution's produced very odd things. And the big question, which biology can't really answer, is did this happen sort of randomly? Is it just a random result of more efficient purposes going on? Or is it this actually an aesthetic that has some deeper meaning than just accidentally coming up? Nobody knows the answer to that.
Well, it certainly does go back to the fact that you talked about a little bit at the beginning, the fact that that birds, in the kind of music they make, it's very different than other animals and their capability to produce sound. That is, few animals can learn to make sounds.
Right.
Our closest relatives, the primates, can't do it, but songbirds can do it. Human beings can. Whales and dolphins can. It raises the question, well, why them? Why not more, and why specifically them?
Yeah, I've had some scientists say to me that, you know, evolution must select against vocal learning. It must be more efficient not to have it. You know, it's a good thing not to have in general. That's why so few animals have it. But why do those few animals have it? You know, it enables other ways of living together and communicating, etc. But it's clearly not the easiest way to go. There are primates that sing, of course. There are gibbons that sing and indries, you know, which are kind of lemur. But they are born with the ability to make those sounds. You can't teach them something else.
You mentioned just kind of as a side story, I think it's particularly interesting, this idea that there was a time when people made a business out of, and it was a fashion to teach birds to sing, and that there were, do I have this right, that people actually composed music for birds to be taught to birds?
Oh, yes. It's a famous book that you can still use to learn to play the recorder in school. And at least in Australia, everyone seemed to know about it because they learned from this book, The Bird Fancier's Delight, little tunes to teach birds to sing. And they're not tunes that are particularly close to what the birds sing, but it's a good idea in any case. And then I also learned that the word recording, like in tape recorder, that what it first meant was, to learn a tune. You got to record it when you learn to sing. And it was early on used with the idea of teaching birds to sing. We got to get these birds to record. And that's why the instrument's called the recorder, because it was so often used to teach birds to sing. Pretty hard to believe, but
it makes a good story, I guess.
You know, a few people have written it down, so it didn't just come out of nowhere. You know what? I've always wondered, actually, playing the recorder, why it's called a recorder, and there's also a tape recorder. I wondered about that when I was 8 years old, learning to play the recorder. How come the words was the same? Nobody seemed to know. But it's definitely true that people have listened to birds, thought their sounds were musical, enjoyed these sounds, played around with them, and really been touched by them for thousands of years. There's evidence, and people still are today, and we're not quite sure what to say about it. And I think people too often stop wondering. They say, oh, I know what this is for, so I'm not going to say anything more about it. Or they say, oh, I know that's a robin, so they stop listening to it.
Yeah.
Instead of wondering, what exactly is he doing? Why is it put together this way and not that way? There's a whole world of interesting things you can hear just in your backyard.
Let us, we have a couple of callers here. Let's talk with them. We'll start with our caller on line number one in Champaign. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Fascinating subject. I wonder if you can help me with something. I've often wondered, with respect to birds, to the extent that, and this seems to be part of what you're talking about, to what extent do they make choices, and are they conscious of making a choice? You know, like, obviously a bird, it's not obvious. Maybe you'd care to address that?
Yeah, that's an excellent question.
Thank you.
That, you know, you're saying, do they make choices? Do they decide what to sing next? What song are they going to sing next? Are they conscious of what's going on? Well, there's a lot of people who say, well, we're never going to know how conscious they are because we can't get inside the mind of the bird that way. We don't know what they're exactly aware of. Others say, oh, we can figure out how to stick little electrodes in the brain and figure out what they're aware of. And but in terms of making choices, you know, people investigated different ways to look at, you know, how do you decide what song comes next? It definitely seems that whether conscious or not, birds do not sing randomly if they're singing a complex song like a mockingbird. There's a real structure to it. There's a real order. There's a real design to the long songs of a mockingbird or of a robin or of even a starling. Now, are they aware of this? That's much harder to know about. But there certainly is a sense of order and plan that you can, you know, demonstrate by mathematically. You could look at probabilities. What's the chance this phrase is going to come next? Some people use that approach. Others would take the musical approach and say, well, listen to how this is shaped together. Listen to how these decisions that the birds made, either consciously or unconsciously, end up with this song that has a certain beginning, middle, and end. Two different approaches to that.
Of course, with the question of consciousness, there can't be consciousness without ego consciousness.
Well, you know, this is something that people argue about, that there's enough people who think that even human beings don't have consciousness, that we're just making all these little decisions and no one's really in charge. So the same arguments have to do with birds. You know, brain scientists really like slicing open bird brains and looking at what's happening there, and they've identified all kinds of specific things going on. This pathway fires up when this sound is made, when this sound is heard. All this stuff has been identified, but you can't find consciousness that way. No one's ever found consciousness by saying, oh, it's here.
Kind of the ghost in the machine concept.
That kind of thing, it's just as hard.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks for calling.
All right, let's go to Atlanta, Illinois, on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Good morning. Thanks for the conversation.
Sure.
One negative aspect of, we live in next to a nature preserve and probably have about 100 species of birds visit here every year, and at, you know, a daybreak with the windows open, that can be really an awakening thing. You just can't believe all the different bird calls that are going on in that time. But something to reinforce some of the things that you've said, we have a real large feeding station that's easily visible out the back of the house. And for the last several years, we've had a downy male. Now, I don't know whether it's always the same downy male, but I'm assuming that is, that every once in a while throughout the day, he'll fly up to the pole, and he'll slide down the pole. He'll fly back up to the top of the pole, and he'll slide down like he's having fun, and he won't eat. He'll just pretty soon get tired of the game and fly off. So, in kind of answer to the other question, maybe there is some conscious behavior birds do, and, you know, they like to have fun, which includes the singing aspect that you talked about. And after I threw that in, I'll just hang up. Thanks a lot.
All right.
So you're talking about a downy woodpecker? Sliding down a metal pole?
I guess, yeah.
That sounds pretty fun. I could imagine. He might be enjoying himself, or he might be confused that it isn't wood. And, I think that there's plenty of scientists who think that birds may very well be experiencing joy, and they're trying to figure out how to measure it.
Hmm.
How can we figure this out so we can be more sure of this?
It gets us to this interesting and difficult issue. I'm sure that some people would say, when you try to take human experience, human emotion, human feelings, and project that onto animals, that at least scientifically, you're on really shaky ground. Well, of course, we do that all the time. Is there ever going to be any way other than if we look at our experience and how we're feeling, and we look at everything we can observe about the animal, simply making the leap and saying, well, I'm feeling this, and this is what's going on, and this is what I'm seeing in the animal, and why not make the leap?
Well, you know, there's many ways you could talk about that question. I mean, one is that, you know, you say that we talk about emotions and joy and enjoyment and music, and isn't that just a human construct? But I'd say it's equally a human construct that nature is divided into numbers and exact measurable things. You know, that's just another human way of seeing the world, that we can count everything, that we can measure everything, that we can call this objective. And actually, it's very doubtful that the rest of the world sees it all that way. It's more likely that birds experience things in a more simpler emotional way than this whole mathematical exact way that we say, oh, the bird calculates, you know, the 50% chance he's going to sing this phrase next. You know, that's really a particular human way of looking at nature, isn't it?
Hmm.
And also the whole idea that to assume that nature is all like a machine, that only we have emotions, only we have music, that's equally, you know, human biased, I would say. than to say, well, who knows, they may be experiencing all kinds of interesting emotions.
Yeah.
Whether you can test emotion and these kind of softer things is, you know, a serious question that science and evolution ought to think about.
Hmm.
It's harder to conceive what it would mean to test it, but it doesn't mean it's not worth thinking about. Although I did find, you know, many scientists I talked to thought the kind of things I was interested in, they'd say, oh, that's interesting, but they didn't think it was within the scope of their way of seeing the world. But others found that they'd say, oh, you're talking about things that one day we're going to figure out how to address scientifically, maybe 20, 30 years from now.
Well, I'm sort of thinking about the fact that within science there was a time, and I think actually not all that long ago, where there were scientists who argued that animals didn't feel pain.
Sure.
And that now I think we've gotten a little bit past that, and I know anybody who has lived with a companion animal will know that, in fact, yeah, they do, and it's not that, maybe not that much of a jump from the idea that, well, if they feel pain like we feel pain, you know, my analogy is, well, you step on my foot, I'll say ow. If I step on my cat's foot, he says ow. So it's not much of a jump to think, well, he's experiencing the same thing. And from there, I suppose, it's also not much of a jump to the idea that if you feel pain, you might indeed be able to feel that if the animal feels pain, the animal might indeed be able to feel joy. And it would be something like that feeling that we have that we use that word to describe.
Yeah, I think that makes sense.
Well, let us talk with someone else here. We have a caller in Charleston, and that is line number 4, our toll-free line. Hello.
Yes, I tuned in late, and I hope this comment is germane. But I feed birds, and, of course, squirrels are everywhere. And so they climb the bird feeder whenever they can. I have a baffle, and so I've just stopped them there. But I had a small tree to the side of it, a young squirrel. I observed this out the window. He tried to go up the bird feeder twice, and of course the baffle stopped him. Then he climbed the tree, and it was too far of a jump to get from the tree to the bird feeder. So he tried that several times, and finally climbed down the tree, laid on its back, and had a fit. It was the oddest thing I ever saw. And it just laid there, and then it got up and went on its way. But the frustration, which, you know, we perceive as a human emotion, if that was a display of that, then I was witness to something that I hope is part of what your conversation has been about with pain and other aspects of animal emotion and behavior. Would that be, do you think that was a plausible, maybe I misinterpreted it, but it appeared to me, you know, I raised several children, and I saw them frustrated and disappointed and reacting, you know, not in that, not just lying down. Some did, but is that a possibility in the animal
kingdom? Makes sense to me. There's one more example that, you know, emotion appears throughout the animal world.
Yes, well, it was something that I have wanted to share, so
thanks for telling us.
All right, well, thanks for the call. Our guest, perhaps I should introduce again our guest, David Rothenberg. He's professor of philosophy at the New Jersey Institute of Technology. His work has been profiled on National Public Radio, the BBC. He's also written for The Nation, Sierra, and BBC Wildlife. His previous books include Sudden Music and Is It Painful to Think? He is also a composer and jazz clarinetist, and he is known on the musical side of things for his bringing together improvisation, musical improvisation with the sounds of nature, one of those sounds being the sounds of birds. And he's the author of the book Why Birds Sing, A Journey into the Mystery of Birdsong. Basic Books is the publisher. There is also a CD that accompanies the book. It does not come with the book. They're separate items. However, it helps to illustrate the points that he talks about in the book. And that CD is titled Why Birds Sing. I'd like to maybe play a little bit of something else from the CD. Is there something in particular that you would suggest we might want to play?
Well, you could play the last track, which is a different way of making music with birds, and that I took a hermit thrush song and slowed it down in the studio and then wrote a bass clarinet line to go along with it. So it's kind of more reflecting on the whole harmonic and musical possibilities in just one bird song.
Okay, well, maybe we can do that. Can we play cut number 12 on the CD, the last one? This is, the title is No Water and No Rock. And we're waiting for it to queue up, and the CD music. Okay, here we go. Again, there you have it. Our guest, David Rothenberg, playing the bass clarinet, along with the sound of a hermit thrush, which was recorded and then slowed down. And this is one of the tracks. It's final track on his CD, Why Birds Sing. Anything else you want to say about that?
The title comes from T.S. Eliot. He, among many other poets and writers, was very impressed and transfixed by the sound of the hermit thrush, and he wrote some lines about it. In the middle of the wasteland, I believe. And clearly it was a song he remembered from his days in the U.S., since he was living in England at the time, that, you know, it's the sound that just has just, in its original form, much, much faster, kind of lifting away into the heavens, and it's very far away, in a sense, from normal human music, but people have found it musical for you know, a few centuries at least, and have been transfixed by it, even though it's very far away from any kind of human music we're used to, suggesting once again that it's not really a stretch to say that birds are making music, and that we can appreciate it, and through slowing it down and playing along with it, I wanted to get inside the musical sense and aesthetic of the hermit thrush and see if I could change my own music by in the process of doing so.
Well, for a long time when it came to recording bird song, the all human beings could do, they had to rely on a pen and a piece of paper and in some way to transcribe it, either by using standard musical notation or using something that they would invent. And that, of course, now we're used to this idea that somewhere, someone, and maybe different someone's different places, tried to have come up with a way to describe the various calls of birds. You know, and that's why it is we say that the wren says tea kettle, tea kettle. I don't know who made that up, but once you've heard a wren, you'd say, well, okay, I get that. Now, of course, we have a recording that is, we can use a tape recorder or some kind of other recording device, and we can do it that way. We don't have to rely on being able to transcribe with musical notes or something. Now that we actually can do that kind of recording and we can do analysis various kinds of ways, has that made it easier to study bird song, or does that actually make it more difficult?
Well, it's sort of necessary for science to decide bird song is worthy of serious consideration, because scientists can say this is more objective. And in addition to recording, they can print out the song on paper, kind of using the technology called the sonograph, a device invented at the end of World War II that enabled sound to be printed out. And then they could look at it and visualize things that were hard for us to hear and identify subtle differences between some fast-moving song, something that we couldn't hear by just listening to the recording. Hmm. And so a lot of bird song study is looking at sonograms, recognizing that we human beings can't hear all that well, but we can look at, you print it out, you turn it into data, it's easier to analyze. But, you know, this explains why before there was sound recording, scientists didn't think bird song was something they could be objective about. Like naturalists of the 19th century talked about the size and shape and color of birds because they could, you know, take it down in a detailed way. But the sound was something that appeared and then disappeared. You had to trust your ears. And our ears are notoriously fickle in being sure on how to write something down. You know, you can say that the Carolina wren is tea kettle, tea kettle, tea kettle. But you hear one, you know, is that exactly what it's doing? No.
No.
But it helps you remember it.
Yeah. Let's talk with another caller here in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hi, I'm coming to the program late also, so excuse me if I'm being redundant. But I was wondering if your guest is familiar with the organ music and the orchestral music of Olivier Messiaen, the French composer born in 1908 who incorporated bird song extensively in his orchestral chamber and organ and piano music.
Yeah, Messiaen's a big part of the book because
okay.
I talk in one chapter, you know, at least one whole chapter on how, you know, what musicians have done, you know, over the centuries with bird song. I talk about how when Beethoven and Mozart were using bird song, they were much less attentive to the song than, say, Messiaen, who traveled around the world transcribing in detail songs of birds.
Well, I'll have to look at your book.
And, you know, I had heard he had gone to Australia to hear this bird with an incredible song, the lyrebird. And I found the same guy who took Messiaen out there and
took
me into the forest. Instead of just of transcribing it, I decided I wanted to play along with this bird.
Sure.
The end of the book is
fascinating
that
approach.
Place.
Well, thank you.
So, yeah, you should. You might like the book.
I will check it out. Thanks
a lot. Well, thanks for the call. And in fact, that there is one of the cuts here on the CD we played a couple from, the Why Birds Sing. There, you do play with the lyrebird.
Right. Yes, the Albert's lyrebird appears on three different cuts, and there's a superb lyrebird on another cut. Some of them were playing along live with them, myself and the flutist Michael Pestel, and also in other ones who taken the lyrebird song, put it on tape, and played along with it later in different forms. And the lyrebird, you know, this bird, you know, has a song. It really takes him 6 years to learn to sing it. They live like 30 or 40 years at least. No one's quite sure. And it really has a beginning and a middle and end, a whole complex structure.
Mm-hmm.
And that's unlike most bird songs, but it's a, you know, pretty incredible performance. It's full of interesting noises and strange rhythms and not what we immediately think of as melodic, you know, easily musical stuff. But it's also very beautiful. And it's its own aesthetic. I really think each species has its own kind of sound that it likes. Sometimes just one short little phrase is enough. Others, it's a whole way of dealing with many, many different sounds.
Let's talk with someone else. Champagne, this is line number two. Hello.
Hi, good morning. I want to relate a story to you about a different kind of bird song. I was in my garden some years ago and was down on my hands and knees, and a blue jay flew into the window behind me, immediately broke his neck and was dead, and landed very close to me. And the mate of the blue jay was in a tree nearby, and it spent the next 15, 20 minutes, whatever, calling and calling and calling to this bird. It was the most sad, anxious, fearful kind of sound. It was just, he was so afraid, and to me he was saying, why don't you get up? Get away from that person. Get up, get up. And he just kept calling and calling and calling. It was absolutely extraordinary and reduced me to tears. But it was not a bergsong for beauty, but for fear, for anxiousness over the mate. It was just an extraordinary moment. I'll never forget it.
Yeah, but it may also have been beautiful.
Well, in a sort of haunting way, yeah, but he was really, the anxiety was like, get up, get up.
Called
over and over and over again.
Yeah, many people I've talked to have interesting stories about blue jays making sounds, and they make a whole variety of odd sounds that they don't usually make. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, I've heard this once in a while, and people have noted it again and again. One friend of mine who had one in a cage he was rehabilitating said he would sing in his sleep. He would have dream sounds. And I asked some ornithologists about that. They said, oh, I've never heard about something like that, but if it's with a blue jay, it's certainly possible.
Yeah, well, it was beyond the calling or singing for fun or whatever. It's well, I guess what I'm suggesting is there may be other emotions they express.
Certainly, I think you're right there.
Singing,
yeah,
you know, or joy. It was something else.
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you.
All right, well, thank you for the story. About 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580, and again, our guest is David Rothenberg. He's Associate Professor of Philosophy at the New Jersey Institute of Technology. He is also a composer and clarinetist who is known for putting together musical improvisation with the sounds of nature. His book, the book that we've been talking about here this morning, is Why Birds Sing, A Journey into the Mystery of Birdsong. It's published by Basic Books. If you're interested, you can find it out in the bookstore. It's relatively new. And there is also a CD that accompanies it in a sense. They don't come together. They're separate items. You have to buy them separately. But if you're interested in hearing some of the kinds of things we've been talking about, and we have played two cuts now from the CD, you can also look for this CD, and it is entitled Why Birds Sing. And he said at the beginning of the program that when the paperback edition of the book comes out, the CD will be with it. So you
if you can wait a year, then you get it all together.
Otherwise, if you cannot wait, you can rush right out now to the store, and I'm sure you can find both. Questions are welcome here, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. One of the things that we just touched on was the fact that there are some species of birds that will take parts of the songs of other birds and incorporate them into their own songs. And I guess the question is why? Why would they do that? It seems like it raises a number of other questions. If we say particular birds have songs that are special, that are innate, that are theirs, that they sing, you know, for the fun of it, that they are their own compositions. Why would a bird then take pieces of other bird songs?
Well, the short answer, the scientific answer, is we don't know.
the more interesting answer begins by saying, look, you know, birds don't just copy other birds' sounds. They use birds that are mimics, like mockingbirds or lyrebirds, or starlings. They use other birds' sounds as part of their own song. And you rarely would confuse a mockingbird's imitation of a blue jay with an actual blue jay, because the mockingbird takes the blue jay sound and plays around with it in specific ways. The blue jay is going, ew, ew, and the mockingbird will group it together and go, ew, 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 and then it'll change it slightly, merging it like with another bird song, like moving it between blue jay and cardinal. The cardinal's going, pew, 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 and the mockingbird would go, ew, 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 meld them together and play around with it and repeat them in groups of 3, 4, 5, 6, or 7 usually. And you can always tell it's a mockingbird. It's got its own aesthetic approach. Now, if a starling used these sounds, it would just take one copy, one imitation of a bird sound, and mix it around with its own kind of crazy, noisy whistles that are actually, they sound pretty noisy to us, but those that have studied it point out it's actually very organized. Has an exact form, takes about a minute to sing, begins with one kind of whistle, ends with another kind of whistle. And the great bird song scientist Peter Marler, a professor emeritus at the University of California, Davis, he told me, ah, yes, the starling song, it's at the very limits of human comprehension. It's only a minute long. That just shows how far we have to go in understanding these things. So, but why mimic? I mean, one strategy is like a musical one. It's an easy way to get new material. You start copying what you hear, putting it together.
Sure.
But
well,
most birds don't, so you'd have to say evolution selects against this. Huh. Usually doesn't happen. But certain birds use it in the whole strategy of how they develop their song. Now, it seems that blue jays and cardinals are really quite uninterested in mockingbirds imitating them. They don't really care. They don't respond to it as being a blue jay sound. It's just, you know, some foreign sound that's not of great interest to them.
Hmm. When you record a song of a particular bird and then you play it back to that bird, does the bird recognize it as being the song of their species, and do they react to it as if this is another bird, or do they somehow understand that it's not quite the same?
Well, this is one of the main tools of bird song field science. It's called the playback experiment. Play a bird back his own song, or a slight variation of his own song, or another member of his species song, or a slightly different species, and you measure how the birds react and how this reaction, you know, changes with a different playback. And a lot of field research, most of it on song, is based on these kinds of experiments, because then you're supposed to be trying to be getting inside the mind of the bird, something I earlier said was very hard to do. But you're trying to say what it likes, what it doesn't like. And this is, one of the main tools. And birds respond in different ways. Sometimes they respond only to the exact sound. Sometimes they get totally freaked out if you play a recording of themselves, because certain bird species, the subtle differences in the sound identify individuals.
Huh.
And so a whole range of things happen. And then there's the issue that if you play the same tape back too many times, the bird gets used to it and doesn't respond the way you would think he's supposed to. The experiment becomes less useful. That's something some critics in the scientific community have pointed out. Now, as a musician, you play along with the bird. You know, one of the things that when you played those cuts, I kept thinking that in a way, it's so much more satisfying just to play along and enjoy and have fun rather than trying to explain what's going on, rather than trying to answer this question I set out to answer, why birds sing. You know, the answer is never going to be as satisfying as the question.
We're at the point, I'm sorry to say, that we're going to have to stop, and I have a couple of people we can include. I wonder, can you talk just for a minute about the interest in birdsong and how that makes a link to studying the human brain?
The scientific side is that, as I mentioned earlier, not too many animals out of all the animals out there have vocal learning. They can learn to make sound. What's going on in the bird's brain that's similar to the human brain? Let's say doesn't happen in a chimpanzee brain because they can't learn to make sounds. And scientists have been, eagerly looking inside these bird brains and discovered all kinds of interesting things about how they're working. The biggest, most popular, interesting sounding discovery is that when an adult bird learns a new song, among those kinds of birds that can keep learning new songs, like canaries, he grows new neurons in his brain, new brain cells, new pathways are connected. So the brain sort of enhances and repairs itself when it learns something new. And that's a very radical revision of how we understand what the way the brain works. And one day, if we could harness this ability, we might be able to fix damaged brains.
Well,
and so that's the scientific reason. The other thing I would have to say is that what's interesting is that, you know, it's an amazing thing if nature evolves, you know, different beings that can make music and have this musical ability. And they seem to have it in a way before they have the sense of language and more necessary kind of communication. It's very possible that music could have evolved before language.
Well, there we must leave it. I want to suggest, however, to people, if you want to read more on the subject, you look for the book Why Birds Sing by our guest David Rothenberg. It's published by Basic Books. David Rothenberg is professor of philosophy at the New Jersey Institute of Technology, also composer, clarinetist. And if you'd like to hear him play with the birds, you look for the CD Why Birds Sing.
Or check the website whybirdsing.com to get a taste of the whole thing.
Very good. We appreciate you giving us your time.
Thanks a lot for calling.